You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, my guest, Kavita Moudon-Finn, joins me to talk about maybe the best chapter yet in A Clash of Kings. In this chapter, Renly's intentions are revealed. We anticipate the arrival of Stannis. And of course, we are introduced to one Brienne of Tarth. Kavita, formerly of Cambridge and Oxford, and MIT, is an expert in medieval history and literature with specific attention to courts and courtly women. So she's the perfect person to join me to cover this chapter. Then after that, Jan Wilson and I discuss Tywin's war strategy. Okay, without further ado, here is Dr. Kavita Moudon-Finn. Kavita, I'd like to ask you a question about kingship.
Mm-hmm.
Is there such a thing as a good king?
Oh, are you asking me as a historian or are you asking me this on like general moral grounds?
I'm hoping for more of a sort of a comprehensive, holistic approach to the question. I mean, I was raised on, you know, Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, which presuppose like the final outcome, the outcome that you actually want in order to make a happy ending, presupposes the idea of a good king. And then in this chapter, you know, this is sort of Renly's claim to the throne. Well, guess what? I would be a better king than Stannis. He's a bad king and I'm a good king. So I guess I'm curious about your take on the notion of a good king.
It's a very interesting question because on the one hand, it's a very old idea. It's an idea that has been around as long as the idea of monarchy, basically. It is your aspiration where monarchy is concerned is to be a good monarch. Now, what does that mean? Presumably, on some level, it means stability. It means creating a situation where the people who have put you in charge one way or the other, whether that's through lineal succession or election or what have you, the people who put you in charge did so because they think you will do a good job running everything. And if you do a good job, perhaps it is as simple as that. Like, you are a good king if people can look back on your reign and say, oh, it was peaceful, it was prosperous,
right,
it was what have you. But of course, on the flip side, how much of that is within one person's control? So while it is very easy to point to a king who does a very bad job and go, okay, that, like, you could point to, I don't know, Cersei, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And you could say, well, she's doing a very poor job, but you also have to take into account that some of that is her own decision-making and some of that is factors that were well beyond her control. So whether or not a monarch is good often depends on how they deal with the situation that they are given. Because there are plenty of things that are outside one person's control. The weather. You can't control if you have a giant...
A drought, yeah.
Yeah, a drought. Like, you can't control if there's a drought. You can't, to a very large extent, you can't control, at least in a pre-modern world, you can't control if there's a plague. If you're talking about a sort of pre-modern, pre-industrial world, there are... any natural disaster is going to turn any is going to turn things over. Any war is going to turn things over. Did you start wars or did you end them? Did you attempt to expand your territory? And if so, did you do so in a way that was good for your people rather than bad for them? And so all of these different factors come together to address that question, which is to say it's not an easy question to answer. And it's one of the things that I think the chapter in particular grapples with is it's not a question that can be answered in the moment. It has to be answered in retrospect.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is rewarding to itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club.
But some people aren't the joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them, or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
I think it's important to make a distinction here between maybe a good politician and a good and the notion, the idealized notion of a good king, because I think Renly is absolutely a good politician. You know, in every possible way, Renly seems to, you know, be almost a savant when it comes to politics.
Yeah, he is. And that's certainly the way that he's presented. And I love the narrative choice for this, the perspective choice for this. It's really just you get sort of one. I wouldn't go so far as to say seasoned politician, but a seasoned political observer sort of taking all of this in and measuring it and inevitably just finding it wanting. It's like it's all surface and no substance.
Right.
And I think, and what I love is that Kat sort of zeroes in on that right at the beginning. She's like, this is all shiny. This is all surface, all superficial. Everything looks great. But the second you poke at it, even a little bit, the whole thing falls to pieces.
Yeah, right. Right. I mean, I guess you could say, just by sheer numbers, there is some substance because who's got the biggest army? Renly does. Now
he does. They don't have any.
they don't have any. They're not blooded, or you know, they don't. They're just kind of playing at war, or whatever. They've had lots of attorneys and whatnot. But in terms of just sheer manpower, there's definitely the potential for substance there.
There's substance in the sense that their presence prevents other people from doing things.
Right.
Because no one knows what he's going to do, and they're all watching him. And so that is where, like, the sheer numbers get you. It's like, if you have an army of 40,000 people and they're sitting in one place, everyone else who's sort of moving around is going to be watching them, trying to figure out which direction they're going to go. So yes, there's absolutely substance under that power.
Yeah.
And the question is sort of, what is it going to be used for?
Right. Yeah. And does Renly know how to use it? I mean, mm-hmm. So far he's made no mistakes because he's made no moves. Right?
He hasn't done anything.
Right.
It's easy not to make any mistakes. If
I mean,
you're not doing
but
anything.
There is something to be said for, okay, my enemies are bludgeoning each other. I'm going to sit back and wait for, you know, the casualty count to come in.
Yeah. It's a smart move. I'm not saying it's a bad move. Right, it's just amusing. It's just an interesting thing to see.
Right. So I think that Renly is absolutely a politician. I don't know if there is such a thing as a good king. I feel like, you know, this is a narrative that even sort of bleeds into the modern news because, I mean, what do you, you know, it's almost like modern presidential politics. What are you running on? Well, you're supposed to run on the economy, but how much does the president actually, how much impact can the president actually make on the economy? It seems like he's one factor in like 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, whether the economy is good or bad or whatever, it seems like the sort of the popular narrative is to kind of rest that on the shoulders of whoever happened to be sitting in the Oval Office. But like you're saying, there's
much more complicated than
that. Is there such a thing as a good king? The answer is, well, what kind of luck did that person have? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, you can. I do believe there's such a thing as a bad king.
There absolutely is. No, it's one of those aggravating situations where it's much, much easier to point out the bad examples than it is to point out the good ones, because the bad ones are super obvious.
Uh-huh.
But on the other hand, just to kind of play devil's advocate a little bit, even with the bad examples, you do have to take circumstances into consideration, because you have a king who shows up in, and there's already a civil war going on. That king is already going to be dealing with more problems than a king who was ruling in a time that wasn't civil war.
Yeah.
And that happens with a great deal of frequency. If you're looking at kind of medieval and early modern Europe, you are constantly having kings coming to power in times of war. Or you have a king who comes to power when he's a child. How well is that going to go? Not very well under most circumstances. Usually what that is just an invitation for a civil war.
Right. Yeah. I'm going to read my synopsis for this chapter, and then we can talk more about the specifics here. Catelyn wakes in the grasslands and breaks her fast with oatmeal and thistle tea. Amidst fear about her family and the kingdom, she rides to meet Renly as Rob's emissary. Renly is encamped with a massive host, and Kat is awed by the size of it. Renly, who is presiding over a tournament, greets Catelyn with courtesy, and they discuss recent events and future prospects. After averting several possible arguments about who is king and who is a pretender, Renly invites Kat to Lord Caswell's feast. Brienne of Tarth, who has been newly appointed to the Rainbow Guard, exchanges barbs with Kat until Renly invites her outside for a walk. Renly impresses upon her the need for Rob to join him and acknowledge him as king. Then Stannis arrives. Bum, bum, bum.
Dun, dun, dun.
Kavita, you have the floor. What are you going to talk about today?
Oh, goodness. Well, there's so much in this particular chapter. It is so rich and full of symbolism and complexity
absolutely.
And analysis. There's too. There's lots and lots of things to get into, but I did like your original angle because it does kind of cover a lot of the themes that that are running through this chapter, because it's not just about kingship. It's also the first chapter where we meet Brienne of Tarth, who ends up becoming such an important character later on in
That's
the series.
Right.
So, and of course, her entire story is tied up in notions of sort of moral good versus systemic good, appearance versus reality. All of those things keep cropping up in hers, in her story. So I think that it intertwines really nicely with what you were talking about, kind of the appearance of kingship versus the actuality.
Yeah, there's almost a parallel here between the discussion of good king and good knight, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think she really does present as the good knight.
Yes.
And then, of course, the question, is there such a thing, right?
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because, yes, she's very much presented as sort of the good example of knighthood. And, of course, the ideas of good kingship and good knighthood are very much intertwined.
Yeah.
They're both part of that same larger kind of chivalric masculine system. And it's all kind of muddled in a way because, of course, knights in times of war, as Sandor Clegane reminds everyone over and over and over again, are there for killing. They're not for looking pretty. They're not for kind of behaving gallantly. They're there to literally kill people. And I think Catelyn in this chapter is reacting to the huge whiplash between what she left and what she and where she's arriving. Because she left an actual war camp. She left a military camp that was filled with people who had fought in actual battles, and who were dealing with kind of the hardships of being on the road and being in a military camp. And she shows up at this basically tropical resort in the riverlands, where in the reach where they're all getting drunk and fighting each other for fate.
Yeah, the chapter right before this talks about the feast at Winterfell.
Mm-hmm.
And it almost pales in comparison to the kinds of food that are and the comfort, the life comfort that Renly has taken with him along the
wealth
road, you
and
know.
The consumption. It's conspicuous consumption all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
And we've also had kind of in earlier chapters in the book, of course, you get kind of Arya in the Riverlands dealing with all of just the horrors are happening.
Eating
there.
Worms and whatnot, yeah.
Yeah, and this is such a contrast. So I think we're getting that from Kat's POV is really interesting. Because she literally can't eat the food partway through. Like, she's sitting down at this feast and she's like, this is too rich for me, it's making me sick.
Right.
Because she's not used to it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. We could talk about a lot of things. One of the things that you mentioned was the introduction of Brienne, and I almost feel like, given her narrative arc, we ought to devote a bit of time to Brienne here.
Mm-hmm. I love her introduction because when she's first introduced, it's so subtle. It's like Kat doesn't even notice her. She's like, oh, there's a knight.
Uh-huh.
That's it. Uh-huh. No one cares. It's like, oh, this knight's fighting someone. Oh, the crowd doesn't seem to like him. I wonder why. like, doesn't recognize any of the armor, doesn't recognize any of the symbols, nothing. At one point, like, she notices that someone in the crowd is shouting a beauty and is like, that's weird. I wonder why.
Yeah.
And it's only when you get kind of the big reveal. And what's interesting is that everyone around her is reacting with anger. And they already know who this is. Like, they're reacting with anger, they're reacting with contempt, and Catelyn's immediate reaction is pity. And
well, okay, different. Yes. However, I think her immediate reaction is horror.
Yes. She's like, oh my gosh, what is this?
She says horror, like, his daughter? You know.
Yeah.
And it's, and, you know, she said with horror. And, but then afterwards, it's like, then immediately it kind of.
It's pity.
It goes to pity, yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah, because
which I thought was interesting because Kat, in previously, there was a woman from Bear Island
Yes.
Who wanted to fight along the men, and she actually was pretty good at it. And so Kat, like, mm-hmm. was sort of a pragmatist. She was like, look, we need warriors. I don't care whether they're men mm-hmm. or women or whatever. If she can fight, she should be able to fight. And she sort of takes this very pragmatic view on this. Mm-hmm. But then as soon as she sees Brienne, she's horrified.
I think it's partly also because of the crowd's reaction, though, because if you look at how, like, who is this man and why do they mislike him so? Mm-hmm. It's partly that, because the way that she's been introduced to this knight is someone who has won in the melee, but who nobody wanted to win. Like, what is right. wrong with this person that everyone right. hates them? And the answer is, it's not this. The knight is not a man. The knight is a woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the horror comes from. It's like, wait, what? Because the women of because in the case of Bear Island, and this is more like, I think we get more about this in the next book, and there's a little more detail provided. But in the case of Bear Island, it's kind of the norm. It's presented as something that's just part of the culture there. And right. even though she side eyes it a little bit, she's like, okay, I guess that's how it is. But there's also a sense she later, I think, encounters the two ladies from Mormont a little bit later on after she spent time with Brienne, and she's constantly comparing them to Brienne.
Right.
Because the way that she talks about them, she says, like, oh, they're so comfortable, they're so confident. This is something that they were born to do. Whereas with Brienne, Catelyn is constantly kind of observing that she never feels comfortable in her own skin.
Mm-hmm. Brienne has a few things going against her. And mm-hmm. I think, number one, there is almost a suggestion that she fought dirty in the melee.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
she pulled Loras from his horse in a way that seemed a little bit like, not sure that was fair and square.
Yeah.
Then, of course, I think we have an ugly woman trope thing happening here,
mm-hmm.
where she's, you know, however good of a warrior she is, she's ever only going to be judged by her beauty.
Yep.
And, of course, you've got the ironic chance, a great beauty, a beauty or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of presents as maybe a little bit less self-aware in terms of the way that she views her relationship with Renly. And we don't have a lot about that. We have mm-hmm. a couple hints here.
Yeah.
So, for all of these reasons, the world is against her, right?
Yeah.
But Renly seems to be for her in a way that almost makes me think, yeah, he is kind of good king, you know? At that moment where I'm almost even charmed by Renly myself.
Yeah, it is like, and I think that we can see it both ways, because, like, on the one hand, yes, he does give her a chance and nobody else does. He is kind to her when nobody else is. Mm. But it's also worth remembering that he's getting something out of it too.
What do you think he's getting out of it?
Absolutely unquestioned worship is what he's getting out of it.
That's true.
Because the way that she treats him uh-huh. is like, she will literally do anything.
Yeah, she'll die for him.
Yeah, she will. Yeah. And I think he absolutely takes her at her word on that. So I think he is aware of her feelings for him, at least on some level,
uh-huh.
And he's willing to use them.
Yeah, that's true.
But at least he's nice about it. So
yeah, we find out that he's been holding that cloak, which means that mm-hmm. it's basically an office for Barristan Selmy.
Yeah, who has disappeared.
Who has disappeared. Now, what Selmy would bring to the table is a certain kind of panache and sort of political legitimacy.
Prestige and authority.
Yeah, prestige, also, authority. Also, you know, experience yeah. in warfare and whatnot. But there's no...
It's mostly about optics, though.
Yes,
it's less about kind of his experience, and it's more about, like, look at who I have. Uh-huh. I have all the trappings.
Uh-huh.
All the trappings of kingship. Is basically what he's aiming for.
Right.
Like, look, I have the giant army. I have the beautiful wife. I have this Rainbow Guard of Knights, and also Look Who's With Me,
right.
The most celebrated guy in the entire Seven Kingdoms.
Yeah, like it's, yeah, that's right. Brienne is almost the opposite. It's like she, yeah. The optics are not good, but man, will she love him. And he's, mm-hmm. I think he has figured that out. He's figured out the most fundamental thing for kingship, or at least, you know, this is what he believes, is do they love you?
Mm-hmm.
They do not love, they fear Stannis, they respect Stannis, they do not love Stannis.
They do not.
And
he's not very
lovable. They will love me, and here's the proof of it, right? So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, Brienne is, functionally, she's kind of important for telling the story of Renly. But in retrospect, it's almost like, it was actually the reverse. It was Renly who was important for sort of creating the first cracks of the cocoon so that Brienne could emerge. And it's actually her story we're going to be following.
Yes. Yes, because Kat's going to bow out in the next book.
Yeah.
Not by choice.
Well, I did love, I'll read this little part here. There's a little foreshadowing here. She's looking at a breastplate that has a great sheen to it, so she can actually see a reflection. And it says, gazing back at her as if from the bottom of a deep pond, the face of a drowned woman, Kat thought. Can you drown in grief? And I think, of course, this is just a beautiful little foreshadowing image of what happens with...
Yes. Yes, it is.
She's going to be killed and dragged on the bottom of a river, right? So she actually will be a drowned woman. But she specifically draws out the metaphor of grief, which is, I do think, is part of her narrative even more than the drowning.
Oh, yeah. Right. Grief and vengeance.
All right, let me ask you this question. Kat mm-hmm. is very critical of everything that Renly has done.
Yes.
Stark wants a pact with us. He should come himself. Not hide behind his mother's skirts.
My son is fighting a war, not playing at one.
Don't worry, my lady. Our war is just beginning.
You know, he's playing at war, he's feasting, he's bringing creature comforts with himself on the road. He actually didn't help Ned in his time of need, even though Ned refused, you know, an offer. He's forgotten about Stannis. Like, everything that Renly does is wrong, basically.
Yes.
And I wonder if it's warranted. I wonder if that's kind of her perspective on this. In reality, this guy is in the best position to take the Iron Throne.
It's very interesting because on the one hand, yes, she is seeing through a lot of what's going on. And she's able to say, like, well, why are you doing this when there's such devastation happening several hundred miles north of where you are?
Yeah.
Because I think that's part of where the judgment comes from, is because she's seen how ravaged everything has been. And she's seen people starving. She's seen the villages destroyed, the homes destroyed. Because it's worth remembering that the way that she traveled, geographically speaking, Catelyn would have traveled right through the worst of Tywin's campaign in the Riverlands.
Huh.
Like, she would have seen the after effects of that. And so going from that to what Renly has set up, while yes, I don't know that it's necessarily entirely warranted, I can see how she got there. Because it's a night and day difference between what she has left and what she's now seeing. And I think especially the tourney rubs her the wrong way, because she has just seen, like, she witnessed multiple battles, like actual honest to goodness battles, yeah. Where her son put himself in physical danger every single time.
Yeah.
And she has already seen, like, Lord Karstark's sons got killed.
Well, and her father's on death's door, right?
Yeah, and her father's at death's door, and her brother is fighting in the Riverlands. and her kid and her two children are still trapped in King's Landing, and right. her other two children are back in Witch. Like she is dealing with so much right now, and to see Renly, who, as you say, is the best placed to actually do something in yeah. this situation, the best place to actually take on Tywin Lannister. To see him sort of hanging out and feasting and having a great time.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Like, I can absolutely see why that makes her angry.
Well, and also, even though she's not from the North, she's become a Stark. And
yeah, these are
and
her people.
Her image of what it means to be a serious man mm-hmm. and a man of wisdom is Ned. It's Renly is anything but Ned, right?
Yeah, she looks at him, she's like, oh, you're such a baby. Uh-huh. You have no idea. These are the nights of summer and winter is coming. Like that, I think that encapsulates everything. She's like, that, like these, you're playing at war.
Uh-huh.
It's, I love the put down that she gives to Randall Tarly. And I love that that is our introduction to Randall Tarly. Yeah, like after all of the horrors we get from Sam's chapter, when we actually meet him, uh-huh. he's having his butt handed to him by Catelyn.
Yeah, right.
That's
yeah.
so satisfying. I don't think he'll ever find out, but that was very satisfying.
Oh, goodness. Okay, so this brings me to an interesting exchange between Cat and Brienne. And I mm-hmm. think it... I think that in order to kind of hear this correctly, we kind of almost have to set aside the Brienne we meet in the show.
Yes, but, yes, we do.
Okay, so... Kat is having a conversation with Lord Rowan, and mm-hmm. she's looking around at the table and saying, you know, mentioning all the things we just mentioned.
Yeah.
And she pities them because they're all mm-hmm. young and they think they're immortal. And he says, why pity? And she says, because it will not last, Kat answered sadly, because they are nights of summer and winter is coming. Now, okay, now Brienne speaks up.
Yeah.
She says, Lady Catelyn, you are wrong. Brienne regarded her with eyes as blue as her armor. Winter will never come for the likes of us. Should we die in battle, they will surely sing of us. And it's always summer in the songs, and in the songs all the knights are gallant, all the maids are beautiful, and the sun is always shining. I thought that was a very interesting statement. And almost, and I'll get your take on this, it almost underlies a little bit of realism and a little bit of cynicism on the part of Brienne.
Yes, on the one hand, Brienne is very cognizant of, like, I mean, she understands it. I don't know that she understands it on a visceral level until we get to A Feast for Crows.
Uh-huh.
But she does understand that the choices that she has made, the choice to enter the life of a knight, is one where she may well die. The goal isn't necessarily to not die. The goal is to die in such a way that you will be remembered.
Yeah, she's almost resolved to do it. She's like, look, I've chosen a life where mm-hmm. I will die young and glorious.
Yes, it's part of that that chivalric masculinity. What is more important than your own life is your legacy.
Right.
And the way that you... the way that you create that legacy is by dying gloriously in a good cause, or what is perceived to be a good cause.
And this, okay, so this, we don't get a lot of information, but this coupled with the fact that she kind of fights dirty a little bit during the tourney, mm-hmm. but wins the tourney because of it.
Yep.
And then this little statement that almost, it's on the surface, it could read as, idealized view of knighthood.
Naive.
But underneath yep. it, it's almost like saying, yeah, of course I'm gonna die young, but don't pity me. You know, I just feel like this is a very different picture of Brienne of Tarth than I've seen in the show.
Yeah, and I think Brienne is naive to some extent just because she's young.
Yeah.
She's only 17, 18 years old.
Right.
So she's just a kid. But in as much as she is a kid, she has experience with kind of marginalization in a way that most of the knights surrounding her, particularly someone like Loras Tyrell, does not have, or someone like Renly for that matter.
Right.
Like everyone takes Renly at his word. Everyone gives Renly the benefit of the doubt. Renly gets away with everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he even gets away with literally claiming a throne for the lulz. Like, he decides that he wants to claim the throne, not because he has any sort of specific right to it, but because he thinks he'd be better than Stannis.
Right.
His entire thing is rooted in, I'm better than Stannis, therefore I deserve this. And it doesn't even occur to him to sort of take a step back and go, hey, maybe I shouldn't start a war in the middle of a war that's already happening.
Right. Well,
it doesn't even occur to him the amount of damage right. that he's causing.
And I almost feel like, okay, so we were talking about the difference between Brienne show versus book.
Yes.
Renly is different in the show as well. And I feel like when I read Renly in this chapter, this is a man that's just brimming with confidence. He's almost overconfident.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone else is kind of defensive of his stature as king. It's almost like he's like, he kind of laughs it off.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, it makes him a good politician. It makes people, you know, people are drawn to him because he's an easy smile and pretty confident. And he looks he looks like Robert Reborn, you know?
Yep.
He's tall and good looking. And I almost feel like the show made him a bit more insecure.
Insecure. I think
that the reason why they did that is they wanted to feminize him in some way.
I think, yes. I think one of the things that they did is rather than stick to this extremely sort of hyper-masculine image, and like, because the thing is, they could have done the same thing with his relationship with Loras that they did in the show, and they could have kept him as this extremely because it's not just that he's confident. This scene is absolutely dripping with foreshadowing. Like, this dude is absolutely ripe for a fall. We know he's going down. The question is how.
Yeah. Right. Yes. And I think that this chapter ends in a way that's almost perfect, you know, because he's discussing his
plans.
He's discussing all of his power and his strategic acumen with Kat, and he says, and don't forget, my brother holds all the waterways. And she's like, I think that you're the one that forgot Stannis.
Yeah, it's like your brother who's currently at war with you.
And then at the end, he legitimately is surprised by the arrival of Stannis. So anyway, I just thought, Renly is very different. Brienne is very different. But in many ways, they're pretty faithful to the plot points. For me, I feel like Renly, if it not for magic, Renly probably has the right of it. He's probably like, I'm pretty well positioned to take King's Landing when I decide to do it.
Whenever I get around to it,
right? And interestingly enough, you know, this, for the purpose of the narrative, his pride just foreshadows his downfall, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of just being strategically right, I think he is right. I think he's kind of looked around and seen all of the people that possibly could have a claim to the throne and kind of made that cynical judgment. No one really has the right to a throne. There are no real Targaryens around here.
Nope.
You know, Joffrey is not Robert's son, and Robert was a usurper in the first place. So his lineage doesn't really matter. Doesn't really matter that Stannis was Robert's older brother. The way that this world works is that if people love you, and if you have a bigger army, and if you happen to be in the right place at the right time, you get to be king.
Clearly he has read his Machiavelli.
Yes, right. Exactly. And so in this way, he's so different than Ned. He's so different than Stannis. And he's got everything going for him. And he's going to die very, very soon.
Well, and I think that Kat has the right of it when she points at... When she points out not only how young everyone is, it's like they do not remember. They're young enough; they don't remember the last war.
Huh.
Because even Renly was only like 6 or 7 years old, like young enough that it would have registered that things were wrong and that things were not good, but it wouldn't have struck him the same way that it did either of his elder brothers, because both of them were very much scarred by the whole thing, in different ways.
Yeah.
And Renly simply wasn't. Like it does not affect him the same way. He doesn't have those traumatic memories the way that all of the other sort of adult characters do. And he's surrounded in, one of the things that Kat notices is he's surrounded by all of these young people who are younger than him. And none of them remember it either. So and it's a contrast to Rob, who is surrounded by these older characters who have all seen other wars and who have all seen other conflicts.
Well, and I think there's a subtext to what Kat notices. Like, she's looking around the room and she's seeing that they're all young, and she kind of says, well, you know, they're going to grow up because war grows people up. And I think that the subtext here is that Renly's about the age Robert was when he took the throne, and Ned was really
just
young.
About.
You know, I was really young, and all of these, you know, back during Robert's rebellion, they were babies. And I think that there is a subtext here that this is generally how men in this world grow up and how women in this world grow up. There's a war that grows them up. But the other thing I wanted to talk about was, I think that this portion of the book highlights the boredom of war, you know,
the tedium.
Yeah, right. I think there's something about, maybe it was Hemingway, I'm not sure, but there was something like, you know, war is like these long drawn out moments of boredom punctuated by terror.
Yes. I don't know if it was Hemingway, but it was World War One.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure. And I think that, you know, what's Rob doing? He's deciding to march because he knows that his men are going to get stir crazy
and restless.
He may not be able to keep his hosts together if they get bored. And then you have, you know, you've got all of the stuff at King's Landing where they're just basically waiting and waiting. Their food supply is dwindling. You know, there is actual horror happening in the Riverlands, but here in the Reach,
nothing.
We have a tournament happening, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, what do you do when you're geared up for war and nothing's happening?
This
is pretty great at showing, like, actually, it will tell you something about someone's personality, what they decide to do during these times.
Because there are a number of things that they could have done with this gigantic army. They could have marched towards King's Landing and laid siege to it. They could have marched north into the Riverlands and joined that fray. There's a whole variety of things they could have done. But instead, they are sitting and they are waiting, which is not bad strategy, all things being equal. Like, it certainly keeps them alive, and it certainly keeps them from... means that everyone else is waiting on them, but it also means that they're giving this impression of being kind of above all of it. And on the one hand, you can make the arguments like, oh, that's very smart, he's keeping his people alive. But on the other hand, it's like, well, what about everyone else? If he's supposed to be planning to rule the entire country and he lets half of that country burn, what kind of a king does that make him?
Yeah. And the stark contrast between the food supply in King's Landing and all of the wealth of Highgarden, basically.
Yeah. And especially later on when it's made clear that they're basically choking the roads so that the food supply is artificially low.
Right.
Like, they are the reason for people starving. Like, oh, well, all these wonderful feasts don't come from nowhere.
Yeah, exactly. Notable introductions in this chapter. We meet, of course, Brienne in her blue armor. We meet Shad. We meet Colin of Greenpools. The Mander River we meet for the first time. And Bitterbridge, which is the seat of the Caswells. And, of course, you mentioned Randall Tarly and his sword Heartsbane.
Randall.
And I thought...
the worst.
Sir Tanton was funny to me. Like, he's like, you know, all bravado, saying he's going to take down the Hound, and you know.
Now, interestingly, we meet Lord Rowan for the first time, yeah. who later becomes kind of this voice of reason around Stannis, which is interesting in its own right.
I didn't remember that. That's interesting.
He does. Like, I don't remember how long it lasts, but he does at least for a time.
Yeah,
no, not Stannis' council. He actually ends up in King's Landing. That's where he ends up.
Oh.
Because he actually ends up in King's Landing. I'm completely misremembering. I switched him with someone else. No, he ends up in King's Landing because there's this great scene where he is in the small council chamber and Tywin is talking about the arrival of the Dornish party. And Tywin is, of course, being completely blasé about the whole thing. And it's Tyrion's POV, and there's this line about how, like, Lord Rowan looked like he was going to vomit.
Sure. In terms of show differences, I really noted the colors. The colors in this chapter are just, I mean, they're very...
So bright.
Yes.
Technicolor. It is like... It is like 1950s Hollywood medieval.
Yes.
That's what this is.
You know, Brienne's armor is bright blue. And of course, I think that this is like an homage to the blue seas.
The sapphires of Tarth.
Yeah. And then, you know, she's looking at Renly's amazing armor in his pavilion. And it's bright green and shine to a glimmer. You know, in the show, mm-hmm. everything was kind of like
drab,
leather and muddy.
It didn't look that different from what we had left behind, which was very disappointing because what you need is that contrast between sort of the ravages of the Riverlands and the plenty of the Reach, because it's supposed to be this contrast. You're talking about the land that is at war and the land that is obviously and manifestly not at war.
Well, yeah, and these guys,
you don't have
course,
that contrast.
These,
it shows.
Yes, these knights, these warriors are unblooded, and their armor is fancy and new, and you know, you've got this, you know, you got sigils and flags all over the place, you know, orange and black butterflies, and you know, everything is very, it's almost idyllic, right?
Yes, it is.
So anyway, I noted that they did that a bit differently.
Yeah,
and then of course, I think we've already noted the difference in Brienne's character, the difference in Renly's character, which I found very interesting, even though the plot points are not that different. No notable departures in this?
No, not yet. That's for the next chapter. That's a lot of notable departures in the next chapter.
Yeah, of course. Was there anything else that you noted about this, like, you know, through, you know, your professional eyes, you noted, oh, that's interesting.
One of the things that I noticed I kind of like to keep an eye on, especially sort of looking at the contrast between the show and the books, this is about as close as we get to confirmation that Renly is gay.
Oh, interesting.
Like,
how's that?
Just looking the way that he's described, the way that he talks about Marjorie, the way that he talks about Loras. I mean, obviously, this is never confirmed. It is never specifically and explicitly confirmed. Later, there's references that were made about Loras, but it's not made explicit the way that it was in the show.
Yeah, in this, you've got the scene at the feast where he's sitting in between Loras and Marjorie.
In between Loras and Marjorie, yeah.
And he'll give, like, Marjorie a little bit of attention, but he just laughing out at all of Loras' jokes and leaning into Loras and... You know, just loving Loras, you know, from Kat's perspective.
Yeah.
And of course, if I had never seen the show, I would just think, man, this guy is just as good of a politician as you as you get. But of course, I do think that Martin has confirmed this about Renly.
Yes. I mean, it's like there. Once you get in. Across the five published books in the series, there are enough references to it that we can pretty much assume that it's true.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, like, it's the way that Kat describes him. She talks about his hair is artless. She talks, this is Loras, mm-hmm. like, she talks about how Loras's hair is artless. She talks about how, like, he's notably beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting that she's one of the few people who doesn't immediately compare him to Jaime Lannister. Because pretty much everybody compares Loras to Jaime Lannister, except for Catelyn.
Interesting.
Because Ned compares the two of them during the Tourney of the Hand, I seem to remember. And of course, Jaime is constantly comparing them to one another.
Huh. Interesting. There is a little hint in the first novel. Renly shows Ned a locket that he has.
Yes, of Marjorie, picture of Marjorie.
And it's supposed to be a picture of Marjorie, and Ned's looking at it, and it looks off to Ned. And my impression of that was that actually it's a portrait of Loras that he's passing
off.
I
thought it was Ned's response was to the Renly's suggestion that Marjorie looks like Lyanna.
Yeah. And
Ned
it doesn't
is like,
look
no,
like
she
Lyanna
actually doesn't
at
look
all.
Anything like Lyanna.
Right.
Yeah, and it's interesting that that Renly is the one who makes that comment, and it does suggest that he doesn't pay very much attention to women's looks. It's like, oh, she has dark hair. Of course, they look alike.
Sure. That's interesting. Yeah. So it is subtle, and if we didn't have the show, I don't know that I would catch it.
Yeah, and I feel like there's a line that Loras has later on that really kind of clinched it for me. It's when the sun has set, no candle can replace it. I think he has that, like, I think he says that to Jane.
Meaning that Renly
is gone, that's why it's his explanation for why he joins the King's
right
Guard. Because Jamie's like, you're so young, you could marry, you could have children, why won't you go do that? And Loras's reply is, when the sun has set, no candle can replace it.
Meaning the love of his life is gone, and now his life is dimmer.
Yep, exactly.
Interesting.
And so he joins the Kingsguard because he thinks that because I've already lost the love of my life. I don't need anyone else. I don't want anyone else.
Right. Kavita, thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome.
What a rich chapter.
Oh, I love, like, Kat's chapters in A Clash of Kings are just such a beast. Like, they're so good, and they're so complicated, and there's so much to dig into. I always love talking about Kat.
Well,
also
the way that this chapter ends, it almost feels like, okay, now things are revving up. Like, Stannis is here. We're finally going to see an
Stannis
actual Clash
here.
Of Kings, you know?
Yes. Player 3 has entered. King 3.
right.
Commission podcasts are an awesome feature here at Bald Move that allows you, the individual listener, to decide what we talk about for a single podcast.
The community loves it because it often leads to fun, fan-favorite films and TV shows that we've overlooked getting the coverage they deserve.
And we love it because we're constantly exposed to great stuff that's not even on our radar.
The way it works is simple. You go to support.baldmove.com and you click on commissions. Then you pay the flat rate for the commission and tell us what 2-ish hours of content you'd like us to make podcasts on.
Then we'll contact you for details, advanced feedback, and any dedications you'd like to make.
Then we watch the thing, discuss the thing, turn it into a podcast, and pump it right into your ears.
We get consistently great feedback on how much our commissioners love their podcast, and they make great gifts for the dedicated Bald Move fan in your life.
And who knows, that dedicated fan could even be you. Treat yourself. Check out support.baldmove.com for more info.
And now Throwback Thursday with comic Steve Osborne.
There's a degree of magic in that. You know, I mean, there is an otherworldly sense of, you know, like when you remove morality, you know, what's a smoke baby at this point?
In the book, she has two smoke babies.
Oh.
Yeah, like twin smoke babies.
Twin smoke babies. Yeah. That's a lot to take care of.
What do you feed a smoke baby? I'm assuming that they don't breastfeed. Only like 45-year-old men breastfeed in this show.
Yeah, pretty much. But that's the thing, is it's like, didn't it become a smoke man? Didn't we see smoke man legs before it?
Yeah, I guess you don't really need to suckle the baby if he just becomes a man right away.
Well, what I'm saying is, now that he's a 45-year-old man, he can breastfeed, because that's the rules of the show.
Yeah, we were talking about the rules of the show, right?
So yeah, yeah. I understand them in regards to everything. Yeah, everything ends like the grapes of wrath.
I wanted to ask you what in the world Tywin's strategy is. You know, we see chapter after chapter of just, you know, the chapter here opens mm-hmm. with this destruction of the countryside and capturing or killing civilians. And I know he's waging some sort of total mm-hmm. war, but then we see the impact of that later in the book when the villagers rise up. They hate the Lannisters. You know, Joffrey is nearly mm-hmm. killed. They are ambushed on their way back to the castle. I mean, the people are furious that their homes are being destroyed and their crops are being destroyed and their families are being torn apart or killed. And Tywin is supposed to be a pretty smart guy. What is his strategy by basically unleashing the mountain into the Riverlands and having him just pillage and destroy everything in his wake? What is the strategy here?
Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like I only know this because I've talked to a few historians on this matter, but it's sort of counterproductive. Mm-hmm. You could say, like, there's a strategy and a consequence to what Tywin's doing. I think that the strategy is, these men from the north, you know, Robb Stark's army, they are short on supplies. So if I burn all of the every possible resource around the Stark army, then they will end up starting to have trouble feeding the horses, feeding them the men, you know, all of that business, and they will end up at a disadvantage because of that. But here's the consequence. The consequence to doing that is you've created sort of that. It's kind of the breadbasket of King's Landing. So you're thinking, well, you know, my children who are in King's Landing are going to be well fed because they're rich. Yeah. And the commoners are, you know, they're going to survive at least long enough so that this isn't going to be a problem. It ends up being a big problem. You know, the people end up rebelling because they're so hungry. So I don't.
It just seems short-sighted for Tywin. I mean, yeah. That seems like something Cersei would do. She doesn't care anything about the people. I'll burn it all down if I have to win. Mm-hmm. But Tywin, I just thought, was maybe smarter than that. And it seems more of a short-term victory as opposed to thinking long-term. Okay, you know, we make it so impossible for Robb's army to survive by burning everything. Great, but once we've won, how do we rule?
Yeah, yeah. Here's one way to think about it. If Tywin is sort of banking on the war being over sooner than later, then the strategy is probably fine. But the longer that he starves the food routes, the longer it's going to be a problem for the people of King's Landing. So I don't, maybe it's a flaw.
But you might be onto something, though, when you say that he assumes that he will win.
Yeah.
And so what's the harm in, again, the short term, we'll burn a few villages, but ultimately we're going to, you know, win against this upstart. Who does he think mm-hmm. he is? Not only is he young, he's not a Lannister. He's not us. And so there's no way he can prevail over our forces, even though everything is proving that to be mm-hmm. untrue. I think everybody underestimated Robb. And, you know, I think at this point in the book, he's doing really well. So, you know, maybe there is this moment where Tywin is beginning to maybe rethink strategy, but it really does seem, I don't know, maybe out of character, just in terms of what we know, you know, about Tywin.
Here's the other thing about this is that it seems like Tywin's strategy is not to face Robb head on anymore. Mm. And he's almost doing this rope-a-dope thing where he's sort of like dancing around the Stark army. And it's almost like he thinks these Northmen they live to fight. If they got a good battle in front of them, they will be motivated. But if I'm just sort of like burning these villages that are maybe a day's ride away and keeping them chasing their tails, they're kind of going to get bored and leave. And that ends up kind of happening for Rob. Because there's no battle like right before his army, they start to get a little bit antsy.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I think there's also something to be said about how, you know, maybe the actual military strategy isn't the smartest, but Tywin has a good ability to pivot. And in the later chapters in A Clash of Kings, it's not coincidental that it's Roose Bolton who shows up at Harrenhal. And so already those plans, that alliance between the Lannisters and the Boltons, that's already happening, unbeknownst to Rob. And so maybe, you know, Tywin is assessing the situation thinking, okay, this is not working in the way I thought. Rob is stronger than I thought. He's not backing down the way I thought. Now we need to use our heads as opposed to our swords. And Tywin, of course, is quite a master at that. So maybe I'm being too hard on Tywin Lannister. Maybe he does know what he's doing. But in the short term, when you're just reading these early chapters, you're thinking, my goodness, this is not the way to win the people. This is not the way to rule long term.